Good evening, everyone. This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're live tonight. This is July the 12th, year 2013. I've let you know that we've been traveling so much that sometimes it's shows out of the archives, but we are live tonight if anyone wants to call in. And we have a fantastic guest speaker, so if anybody wants to ask him questions. But I do want to mention we are having our transformation conference. This is the 8th one. Will be next weekend, July 19th, 20th, and 21st, here in Springdale, Arkansas, the Holiday Inn Convention Center. And our speaker, William Henry, is going to be one of the keynotes at this conference. We're going to have about 12 other speakers. 13 speakers. That are mostly our other authors that we promote. And the other keynote is going to be George Nouri, who is coming. And he's just going to be here for that one day, and he doesn't do this very much because he's always on the air all the time. But William, he said he has worked a lot with you, and you know George, don't you?
Oh, yeah. See, I'd go back probably, I think George's second guest when he took over Coast to Coast AM for Art Bell. And so we have a long, long track record.
Yeah, I'd go back to Art Bell and beyond. I started out with him. And I was one of the first guests that George had on, and I was with the one in between Art Bell and George. I can't even remember his name now.
Oh, gosh,
but,
that's right.
So anyway, we both are very familiar. George, and
yes.
He's going to take a keynote, and we're going to have a dinner and a mixer after his talk where people will be able to ask questions, and they'll be able to talk to all the speakers. So we're going to have a fantastic conference next weekend, but William is going to be the keynote, so I wanted him to come on tonight. He's going to give two talks. So I wanted him to come on tonight to tell us about himself. But before we go on, I want to give the toll-free number in case anyone wants to call in. The number is 1-888-627-6008. 1-888-627-6008. Okay, and William, Julia's here too because she likes to chime in once in a while.
Oh,
hi,
great.
William.
Hello, Julia.
Hi.
Okay. Well, William, the first thing I always ask my guest is, how did you get started in this? Because I know you're an
very
author.
Very fortunately.
No, but you've been author, you've been a speaker, you're like me, you're curious. You always want to find out information for things.
Absolutely. I'm one of those people... that is just a natural curiosity. I love to read. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, where I presently live, and have lived ever since 1982 when I moved here. I came here to go to college. I was going to be an entertainment lawyer and get the music business, all that kind of thing. And I'm a musician, too, and just love the music business. Well, I was at this small Southern Baptist college that offered an entertainment music business program. But the catch was, and it was a wonderful program because you were instructed by professors who were actual working professionals here on nearby Music Row. But the catch was, because it was a Baptist college, you had to take Bible study classes. And having not grown up in a particularly religious family, I mean, we went to church on Christmas, Easter, that sort of thing. I didn't know a thing about the Bible. And one day, a professor assigned us to review a new book, whose implications would impact Christianity. So this was September 1982. I hike it down to my local bookstore, and there on the shelf sits a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Okay, I know that.
Pick it up, and this book is red hot in my hands, and it tells me that the crucifixion of Jesus was a carefully scripted drama. Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. They had all these secret teachings that had been lost, and they ended up in this small village called Rennes-le-Château in southern France. Before I knew it, I was hooked. And from that moment, I just became kind of like the Energizer Bunny and just started reading and reading and reading and reading, still trying to fully understand these great mysteries of who we are, where we came from, what we're doing here, and especially, how do we leave?
Uh-huh. See, you have the same curiosity I have. You know, I've been at it longer, but I've always wanted to know everything about everything. And it's the same way, research and curiosity and asking lots and lots of questions.
Exactly.
We're cut out of the same mold, I think.
I think so. We're from the same tribe.
Okay. All right. So, well, then, where did you go from there? You were doing a lot of reading, but then where did that lead you?
Well, ultimately, in 1990, I started writing children's books.
I had read
Raymond Moody's books about near-death experiences, and there were some other books that came out after that about the afterlife. And one of the books asked the question, where do you go in between lives, in between earthly incarnations? And I thought, well, that's a really interesting question. And before I knew it, I was writing a children's book that it was inspired by that question, and the children's book was called Junior Cosmic Egg. It was the story of a cosmic egg named Junior who wanted to grow up to become his own universe. And
okay.
I started going out and reading to children, to kids, and their parents. And along the way, parents and children, the kids, started telling me about their encounters with angels, with extraterrestrial beings, and all kinds of funny things that would happen in the night. And I started collecting stories about kids' encounters of that nature, and was out on the Whole Life Expo circuit in the early 90s lecturing about it, and as you were, of course, and writing more cosmic egg books. Well, the next thing I know, the works of Zachariah Sitchin land in my lap. This is 1991, 1992, and he, of course, tells the story of these celestial beings, the Anunnaki, as they were called by the ancient Sumerians, who had a hand and intervened in human affairs, and I was instantly hooked on that material. And before I knew it, my work started to shift away from the kids' books and documenting children's or kids' encounters with angels and ETs and other phenomena, and moving more into this area where I'm presently at now of exploring ancient mysteries, our celestial visitors, and their wondrous technologies and all that sort of thing. And it's kept me enraptured all these 20 years since.
Mm-hmm.
In 1996, I published my first book in this area. It was a book that actually, it was called The Peacemaker and the Key of Life. And part of my quest was to set out to discover as much as I could about that incredible magic staff of Moses. There's an amazing history about where it came from, how Moses acquired it, and the possibility that it's still out there somewhere to be discovered. And that was the first book that led into another 16 books. And then in the intervening years, I've written and published 17 books in total about these ancient mysteries, Holy Grail mysteries, ancient stargates, the Anunnaki, all kinds of things, and just absolutely love this area of research.
Okay, I was thinking, you've got 17, I've got 17, so now we're even.
Hey, there we go.
Not that it's a competition.
No, it's not a competition, but we're both involved in the study of, you know, ancient knowledge. I call it a rediscovering lost knowledge.
Absolutely, that's what it's about.
Uh-huh. Because there's so much people don't know. And I said, anything I find that I don't know, I think, well, maybe others don't know about it either, and it would be a good subject for a book or for research. So we have the same mindset anyway.
Yeah,
I hadn't heard about the Staff of Moses. It's kind of like looking for the elusive Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant, I guess, along that line.
In a way, it is, exactly. And at the time, when I first started on that research, I mean, I had no idea that 20 years later I'd still be pursuing these same questions. In fact, my most recent book is about the Ark of the Covenant, and I will be giving a presentation on that book at our conference in Springdale.
Okay.
And I'm going to have some really, I think, surprising things to say about the Ark of the Covenant, where it came from, what its purpose is, and in fact where it might in fact be today.
Well, you know, in my research, I found there was more than one Ark of the Covenant.
I would definitely agree with that.
Did you say you would or would not?
I definitely would. I mean,
okay.
At the very beginning of the story of the Ark of the Covenant, we're immediately told in the book of Exodus that the earthly Ark is a copy of the heavenly original. So that means there's at least two Arks of the Covenant right off the bat. And there were probably many more that were made, especially in ancient Egypt. You see them all over the temple walls, at least depictions of what you could easily identify as an Ark of the Covenant-like device. So I would definitely agree that there's more than one copy out there.
Yeah, and that's what I've heard. There are some, they're still existing, but they're hidden. At least one, anyway, that I've heard of that is still existing and it's in hiding.
It's an incredibly powerful device, and one of the things that surprised me in my research on the Ark, which actually prompted me to write the book, is I didn't know until last year that we traditionally will think of the Ark of the Covenant as a Jewish relic, and that has crossover into the Christian tradition. So it's a Judeo-Christian relic or potential artifact. It's a power symbol associated with Moses. It's the ultimate symbol of the Jewish religion, and it was believed to have been housed, of course, in the Holy of Holies of Solomon's Temple, and will return there one day, according to Jewish end-time prophecy. And even Jesus is associated with the Ark of the Covenant. But one thing that really surprised me that I didn't know until last year was that Islam also has a lot to say about the Ark of the Covenant, where it came from, what its purpose is, and they also believe that in an end-time scenario, their Messiah, whom they call the Mahdi, will actually be the one who will recover and reveal the Ark of the Covenant. So that sets up a pretty compelling scenario that is also potentially pretty tricky, too, because if an Islamic person suddenly shows up with the Ark of the Covenant, the Jewish people aren't going to like that very much. And as a matter of fact,
yeah, I know from my research that they are looking for the return of the Mahdi, so it all goes along with the return of Jesus. But,
that's
you
right.
know, the information, I want you to talk about yours, but, you know, I'm like interjecting here, too. The information I got about the Ark of the Covenant was that it's a communication device, like a radio receiver and transmitter.
That is a very valid aspect of it. It's one, I believe, one aspect of the Ark of the Covenant. It is a communications device. There's no question about it. The Bible is very explicit in that. It's also explicit that it could be thought of as a weapon system. That
yeah.
is perhaps even radioactive, as the descriptions mm-hmm. say. But beyond that, it's also, of course, a container for the Ark, or it's a container, rather, for the Ten Commandments, the Rod of Aaron, which is, by the way,
yeah.
the same as Moses' rod or staff, and also a flask of manna, this celestial or star food, and a jar that contains this really incredibly mysterious anointing oil.
Oh.
And when all of those pieces are assembled, and I view it as sort of a kit. It's like a, you know, it's like a radio set kit that once you put it all together, it is a communications device. It can be used as a weapon, but the Bible is also very clear in its statement when it says that the Ark of the Covenant is also the throne of God. And so when God manifests on the earth plane, He does so through the Ark of the Covenant, and the descriptions describe this luminous humanoid figure manifesting on the Ark of the Covenant. Now, when you look at it from that perspective or read it from that perspective, you're like, well, what is this thing then? And my summation is, or my conclusion, is that it's some kind of a portal or maybe even a Stargate device.
Well, you know, it could have been radioactive because all people had to do was touch it and it would kill them.
That's right.
But there has been debate about maybe it's some kind of an atomic, radiation, and that it was used by the ETs to communicate back and forth.
There's no question. It's a multifaceted, super advanced technology that did, that was brought to Earth.
Well,
and I call it the Judgment Day device because all three religious traditions, big three religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have prophecies about their Messiah figure recovering and revealing the Ark of the Covenant. And so that's, and that of course will happen at a Judgment Day time. Now, what inspired me to write the book and wanted to put it out last year was that one of the figures who was searching for the Ark of the Covenant and claimed that he was in contact with his Messiah was, in fact, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president, the former president of Iran, who made many public statements to the effect that these are the end times, that he has been in direct communication with the Mahdi. And if that's the case, then he must have had some advanced knowledge of the Ark of the Covenant because the Mahdi can't show up without it, which means that those like Ahmadinejad who say they are here to herald the appearance of this figure must know an awful lot about the Ark of the Covenant, and that makes them pretty dangerous people.
Oh, yeah. Julie, you had a statement.
Well, I had
okay.
Based on the description, way you led into what your research and what the Bible said and these different things you were saying, the visual I was getting, and you said it must be a portal, and that's what was saying right before you said that was it's a holographic portal.
I totally agree with that, Julia. I mean, I talk about that in the book. I mean, it seems that what we're talking about here is a holographic projection of this luminous divine being that manifests on the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
That would make sense because they have been, that it is communication device used by ETs, and it would be a way of projecting images.
Right.
And that's why
you're right.
Saying manifesting. Well, it's a different term, like what we think manifesting. Oh, creating something. Well, you manifest when you project a visual, or something. That's a manifestation.
And it was kept in the Holy of Holies in the temple behind the veil, so no one could see it. Nobody could go in there and be around it.
Great, powerful eyes.
Here's the thing.
I'm glad you brought up that veil because this was something that really intrigued me during the writing of the book, and I talk about it in the book. That veil was covered with stars. And the high priest, when he would go through the veil into the Holy of Holies to operate the Ark of the Covenant, he would wear special clothing. And that clothing was made of the same material as the veil. So this guy is wearing a star cloak of some kind, or a cloak or garment covered with stars. Then he crosses through this veil and enters the Holy of Holies. There is a school of thought among specialists in this Jewish symbolism we're talking about here that believe that that was not a metaphorical experience that priest went through. Instead, what they say is that veil was covered with stars because it represented heaven. And when they put on this star cloak and crossed through the veil, they literally entered heaven alive and then traveled through the Ark of the Covenant and then were able to pass back through the veil into the material plane.
Which is your portal theory.
That would be the portal
theory. I mean, it's incredible to think that that's what they possessed in the ancient world atop in Solomon's temple in Jerusalem, and that's what they're trying to recover today.
Sure.
But then also it goes along with the idea of it being radioactive, and it was extremely dangerous that to wear protective clothing to protect them from that.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's several levels here of interpretation that we can talk about or work through, and I think all of them end up actually being correct or appropriate.
Well, and like what you were talking about, it could be a weapon. Well, let's say you go through there and you can project yourself to another time and place. You can be a weapon in that way, or you can do things in other times and places.
Absolutely. One of the other books I wrote was called The Atomic Christ. It was about FDR's search for the Holy Grail just before World War II. He was in a race against Adolf Hitler, who was looking for the same
secret. I know
secret.
They were searching for the Spear of Destiny. That was Adolf Hitler's. I didn't know that, Roosevelt was looking for the Grail.
Yes. He sent a Russian mystic named Nicholas Rurik to Mongolia looking for the portal at Shambhala, and this is all historically documented, in search of signs of the Second Coming and the secrets of the Holy Grail.
Mm.
Now, most people think of the Holy Grail as a simple carpenter's cup, but in the most, we call it advanced or outer edge of the esoteric teachings, the Grail is a teaching about transmutation, about how to take a human being and turn that human being into what we think of as an angel or a light being. And what I believe FDR and Hitler knew is that those same secrets of transmutation could be weaponized.
The government's always trying to think of how to make a weapon out of everything.
Exactly. So they're thinking, oh, transmutation, well, hey, we're trying to transmute the elements right now so we can build a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
We were already deep in our atomic research at that time. We knew that it was a possibility, and there's no evidence or actual proof that says that FDR and Nicholas Rurik found the secrets of the Holy Grail, and it helped us to build the first atomic bomb. But the fact of the matter is that when they built that, it was at a place called Los Alamos, which is in the shadow of the Sangre de Cristo, or Blood of Christ Mountains, next to a town called Magdalena. And when that mushroom cloud went up, it was described as a grail cup.
Hmm.
Wow.
So it just makes you wonder, you know, what's really going on in some of these historical episodes? I mean, are they really tapping into some of these really deep ancient esoteric secrets? And are there beings that, you know, prefer to weaponize that and use them for the power or the love of power rather than what they're meant to be used for, which is the power of love?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but there sometimes there's a little too much coincidence to be coincidence. You know, all these little things.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, but your mind goes in a different direction than mine does. I mean, I'm always looking for convoluted old concepts and theories that we don't know about. But you're going off more into historical, it sounds like.
Yeah, I do tend to have work from more of a historical basis.
Yeah.
It's just kind of what really interests me, and trying to, again, recover our true history about where we came from and what we're doing here, and as I said earlier, when it's time to go, how we can leave. And so that's a primary focus right now. You can call it ascension teachings or light body teachings. This is what where my present interest really lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I've been lecturing on for the last couple of years, is the ascension process. So you're probably coming at it from a different angle than we are, but it is the main focus right now.
Right. Well,
yeah, it's so important, and it's so vital for people to get a hold of this life-changing information, because To me, it really gives us a sense of not just wonderment, but also connection with all that is. And it also has the capability of just making our lives so much nicer and easier.
Well, we're finding out now, you know, you probably are too, with lecturing all over the world, that people are changing. They're becoming more interested. Not so much interested.
Well,
it's like waking up.
You can see the shift. It's a shift of consciousness.
Because they're it's not forbidden knowledge, I guess you would say, anymore. They're understanding it. They're getting it.
Well, let's ask you. Do you see a shift?
Absolutely.
The way of thinking, do you see it changing?
I do. I see people, I think a lot of people cut their teeth on the forbidden knowledge and UFO area. But they recognize, okay, that's a really good beginning place, and they want to know what's next.
Yeah.
And they want to expand themselves, and they feel like the ascension area makes sense. It's a very logical next step, and it it enables them to really go on a real course of self-development, which is a major reason why we're here. And I do see people's interest changing, but I also see people changing themselves. You know, they are really embracing this, and I'd like to think that people are becoming, as you know, so many people had talked for so long, that people are becoming lighter and they're becoming more,
yeah,
maybe even angelic, and are being able to tap into some of their call them superpowers or expanded abilities.
Yeah, psychic powers. Yeah, that's
psychic
what
powers,
I mean.
Exactly.
You know, in the old days, people didn't even talk about this. They didn't even, it was like, you know, they'd make fun of anybody who talked about psychic abilities and everything. But now we're seeing it is a big change. They're not afraid to talk about it anymore.
Well, I see. You can see how it's being in. It's really coming in more and more on the mainstream level. It's just mad.
Well, I'm noticing it. I think it's because of the internet. I'm calling it the internet generation. They're exposed to a lot more. They're more open to it. And at my lectures, they are getting it. They're understanding it where before they weren't. You know, the older people. So we can see a big change in the way people are thinking.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's an interesting process, isn't it, Dolores? I mean, as the my audience tends to skew a little bit to the older generation as well. You know, in late 50s,
yeah,
early 60s, even older, retired. This is their life. And they use every moment of their day to read and investigate, and this is what they want to think about. And they watch all the TV programs, but what I've found is that their children really don't have a lot of interest, but their grandchildren, on the other hand, are almost—they're just lit
That's
up.
What I mean, the internet generation, because you know,
yeah,
I've been doing this for over 45 years. And the last 2 years when I give a lecture, some of the people in the audience say, "We just discovered you." And I said, I haven't been hiding. I've been out there doing this for so long. But it's the internet. They found us all be on there. And that's what I mean.
Well, I think it's just the expansion of all of this.
It's
yeah,
the internet generation are finally discovering things that have been there all along, I guess you would say.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. You know, that there's a term that they use for the internet generation. They call them digital natives. These are people who were born after the introduction of the computer not just computer technology, but the internet. You and I, and Julia, Dolores, Julia and I, we're what they call digital immigrants. We were born before all of this happened.
Yes,
and
yes,
we have to somehow adapt to this new world that we have suddenly found ourselves living in.
Right.
And it can be difficult for some people, but
it
definitely shows.
They can't switch their way of thinking. They're too ingrained, what the church has taught them, and those kind of things.
Digital, though. He's talking about the,
even, I mean, they can't. Some people are having an impossible time trying to adjust to any of this. But it's moving too fast. They can't stop it.
About the internet.
Yeah, but either way, it's all combined. But
yeah,
you can't stop
it. I tell people, it's like, we have such an amazing opportunity at this time through the internet, through our ability to travel, to communicate, to connect with different cultures and their teachings, and to really put some pieces together that would have taken lifetimes to do at any other time in history.
Yeah.
I mean, the last time anything like this happened that I can think of historically was when we had that great Library of Alexandria with over 400,000 volumes, many of them from before the time of the flood. That was the
yeah,
only
she's
time
laughing life. Because I was there in a past life. I was there
when
it destroyed.
I was starting to say, whenever you guys were comparing notes in the very beginning, and how curious you are, and you're bringing back all this knowledge and information, and that's what Dolores has done, and she was in the Library of Alexandria when it was destroyed, and she was trying to save all that information. And I was thinking, when you were talking a while ago, I said, I wouldn't doubt that you were back there in that library with her, and then now you bring it up. So
it gives me chills as you're talking about that, Julia. So I would say so.
So do you know so? Oh, okay. Got it.
Okay. Because that's what people keep saying. Do you know why you're doing this? And I say, oh, yes, I know. But then somebody else said, "Or do you have to try to rewrite the whole library?" Well, that's our goal, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely. To remember it.
Yeah. I think you came back with that mission because you felt so bad about it being destroyed. And then it's like, we've got to bring all this back. It's like, it's a mission. So.
It is a mission. It's truly a mission.
Yeah.
And can't think of anything else better to do. I mean, this is just it. I'm sure, like you, Dolores, and you've been at it a lot longer than I have. I mean, I learned really early on it was that this quest that I'm on and sharing the information is really about the people that I've had the pleasure of meeting and the honor of meeting and being able to serve them by they allow me to read all these books and go seek all this information and put it into a format that they're able to access, and that's a real honor for me to be able to do it. And I love coming to conferences such as yours where I get to meet the people face to face and listen and interact. And so thank you again for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to it. I'll be bringing my wife Claire with me as well, and she too is looking forward to it.
Okay.
Oh, we're so looking forward to having you there.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, we travel all over the world. We were in China.
I know you do.
Three times last year we were in China, and the people there are telling us, we're getting this, we're understanding it. They said they know something is happening, they can feel it. So,
gosh,
you talk to the right people, it is happening. Every guy on the street, they say, I don't know, nothing's going on, but it is.
Well,
yeah, you're incredible, Dolores, because I think the last time I saw you, if memory serves me, we were at James Gilliland's Esetti Ranch.
That
yeah.
was it, during the skywalk.
And I think you were headed to Russia soon after that.
No, that was
we did. It was time after that, but we just happened to run into each other at another conference later.
Yeah.
I was thinking that Gilliland was the last one.
There was one in between. But, yeah, we were out there. They had the sky watch, and it was so cold that night.
Oh, it was awful. I know. And I think you were headed to Russia right after that, or just been to Russia.
Could be, because we go to Russia a lot, too.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It was the 4th of July.
So what you're saying, I mean, this intrigues me, Dolores, because I've studied a little bit of, the acceleration of technology, and I'm told that, like in Asia and the East, they don't view technology the same way that we do. I mean, in America here, you walk around the streets, you're in the mall or wherever, everybody's got their iPhone in their hand, and they're always online and everything. Apparently, they're not like that in the East, and I'm just intrigued if the shift is happening the same way in China and Russia as it is here.
Everybody I saw had an iPhone in their hand.
We were in Beijing and Shanghai, and I'm going back to Beijing in another couple of months.
Oh, and they had iPads in the class. They had all the technology. Yeah, remember that one guy in the front row? He had his iPad sitting there. So
we didn't feel like we were in a foreign country at all.
Well,
except
that you don't understand anybody, but other than that.
Besides what comes out of their mouths, otherwise it was no difference. But I kept saying, where is this China that our government been telling us about, that they were as advanced as us? I couldn't see any difference.
Right.
Wow.
It was like you thought you were in Shanghai, you felt like you were in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of it is propaganda, trying to make you think it was the difference. But they're really up to the same standard we are.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
better.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
That's incredible.
I think they're ahead of us with technology. Now, in Russia, it's a difference there.
Yeah, there's a difference there.
But even there, I was surprised. They are not the poverty-stricken that people lead you to believe. So I always say, you go for yourself and see for yourself, you'll notice the difference. We were in Johannesburg in South Africa, and Julie said she felt like she was in the United States.
I had to keep reminding myself I was not in the United States.
Is that right? Wow.
Absolutely. So, we're anymore. I don't even know where I am much. It's everything merges. And then when I'm in the country, sometimes I have to remind myself that I'm here, because it looks now, it's starting to look like some of these other countries. I mean, really, it's all merging. And I'm not sure.
I know.
Yeah.
You notice,
right?
That traveling from city to city in America, too. It's all the same strip mall. It's all the same shops. It's
yeah.
The same.
That's where the countries are, too.
Yeah, it's the same thing. And it's like, well, in Taiwan, it's just like a little America.
Mm-hmm.
Because we went from Beijing, Shanghai, to Taiwan last year, and there it was like a melding, a mixing of the East and the West, because here they got Kentucky Fried Chicken, and they got everything American. In Taiwan, it's like it's all melding together there. So it's like there's no difference anymore. There's no crossover. There's no lines.
The homogenization, I think they call it.
Oh, is that it? Okay.
Well, anyway.
All becoming the same thing, one world.
Right,
yeah,
right.
And even we were in Istanbul a few months ago, and
it felt
wonderful. And here, they said it was Islamic, and people were walking around with the head coverings, but it was just like being in a modern city. So I think,
well,
I tell people, if you traveled more, there wouldn't be the violence that there would be, because we'd realize we're all the same. There really isn't any difference. People all want the same thing.
I totally agree. I mean, that's absolutely is true. They want a better life for their children than they have for themselves, and they just want a nice, peaceful existence.
Yeah. See, they have different customs and things, but we're all alike underneath the surface. And I'll be going again another month or so. I'm going to be doing another round-the-world trip. I do one of those every year. And so we go to all these countries, and it's just becoming routine now.
Well, and you were doing all those tours in Egypt. Are you still doing those, Jim?
No, we were there during the revolution, and that was quite a story to get out of that. And we did go back about a year later. We went, last time I was there was January 2011, and
okay.
Have since kind of pulled back, and I'm hoping now that they've had a breakthrough with this second revolution that will enable them to go a little bit more stable. I'm told that it's no problem for Americans to tour there. That in fact, tours are going there quite a bit, and so hopefully that'll stay that way.
Well, that'd be great.
Well, Julia was there in 2011.
I was in the fall, though.
We were over there. We have been all over Europe. And I went on to Rome, and she went to Egypt, to Cairo, to the Sphinx and the pyramid. She was going to try to set up something for us for the following year. But she was fine, and she met up with me in Rome. Then after that, no one was allowed to go in.
It was like I slipped in. I got in through a portal, I think.
Because
I slipped in between events.
Because last year we were doing a cruise of the Mediterranean, and we wanted to include Egypt, and they said no cruise ships are going into Egypt.
Wow.
So we thought about you at that time.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, that's that would have been a wonderful stop if you do the Mediterranean and go into Alexandria or something, and then maybe down to Cairo.
Right.
So they must have, it started up right after you were over there, wasn't it, Julia?
Yeah.
And then violence started again, and then they stopped the tourism.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know if it started up again or not.
You have
it has, and I've been told they're successfully running tours there, so.
Okay. Well, good.
Hopefully it'll continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. It was great over there. Do you like it over there? William?
Do I like it there?
Yeah, I mean, I found it very intriguing. I loved it.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it. I find myself craving the flavors of the food and, you know, just the sights. I mean, you can't beat the temples, of course. It's the whole experience of being in Egypt is just
mm-hmm.
awesome.
Well, she didn't like the hard beds. You were probably in a hotel, though.
When?
Oh, in Egypt. When I was there, I stayed in a local, it was a person, they had like a little apartment for rent, they printed out. And the bed, I think it was made out of a slab of stone. I mean, it was so hard.
And she went down into some of these shafts that went way down.
I know he's done what I did and much more.
What about the, what do you call it, the cosmic boats?
No, the solar boats.
The solar boats. Have you seen those in the museum right next to the pyramid?
Yeah, they're just hugely intriguing, aren't they?
Aren't they?
Because she was surprised. She came up, by the way, with some really strange theories about
that. Yeah, I was looking at those, and they were telling me, I'm like, I don't think Mom knows about these. So I was taking all these pictures, and it was so interesting. I mean, why do they call them solar boats, for one? And those oars, you know, wouldn't reach down into water. They're not made for water.
Yeah, I mean,
water.
The whole idea is... you'll see this on the ceilings of temples, especially like at Dendera, the Temple of Hathor at Dendera, where you'll see the gods as celestial beings, and they sail for eternity on their solar boats, which they call the Ark of the Millions of Years or the Ship of Eternity.
Okay.
And what I noticed, and they used to laugh at me when I first started talking about this in Egypt, but now they're kind of more open to it. What I noticed is that the shape of these ancient Egyptian ships of eternity are exactly the same as the shape that modern scientists use when they want to portray a wormhole.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm thinking, this makes sense. The ancient Egyptians are saying their gods are celestial beings. They travel the stars on the arc of the millions of years. Is that what we today call a stargate or a wormhole?
Okay.
And so that's my take on it anyway. And so when you look at the solar boat, the sun boat, or star boat, star ships that they're portraying, what they're saying is that, okay, so the pharaoh had one of these boats, and this is his vehicle, his ascension vehicle. This is how he traveled the stars as a celestial being. And
the one that was next to the Great Pyramid, you know, where they found it, had those huge stones on top of it. Why would it have stones on top of it?
Why was it buried?
Pardon?
Are you asking why was it buried?
I mean, it was like it's a derogatory question, but it's like that's what I was looking at, the way that it was down in the ground, and then they had those huge square, you know, those oblong stones on top of it, laid out in so many feet apart. And it was like, why would they need all these big stones on top of a boat on land, you know? It was like trying to hold it down or something.
And as you saw when you were on the Giza Plateau, I mean, that's all bedrock. That is really hard rock that they had to cut through to cut out this giant pit to put this boat in, this massive boat. It's over 100 feet long.
Right.
It's like, why?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Actually, there's a researcher named Chris Dunn. He wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a theory that the Great Pyramid was a power plant of some kind for...
I
totally agree. When I was inside, the first one I went into, I think it was either the Bent Pyramid or the Red Pyramid, or I don't remember. I saw so many pyramids, I don't remember, but... it's where you went up the outside of it and you went down the shaft. And when I got in it, I thought, this isn't a tomb. The first feeling I got was, this is a machine. It's just this overwhelming feeling. You're inside of a machine.
Absolutely. I totally agree. That's exactly how I felt the first time I went in there. It's like, okay, this is a giant machine of some kind.
Exactly.
And so Chris Dunn says that it was a power plant. And so his take is, and this is kind of interesting, it goes to your, that it talks about that pit that boat, the solar boat, is buried in. He envisions, and he's an engineer by trade, and he marvels at the precision of that the ancient Egyptians showed in their ability to cut very hard rock like granite and diorite, and the precision with which they were able to manufacture their statues. And so he starts thinking about it. He's looking at the precision of the cut stones that they used to build the pyramid. There's over 1 million of them. And what he envisions is that they had a giant saw that was actually in that pit. And it was just this massive saw that needed to be stabilized on the Giza Plateau, so they created that pit for it. And he says that once they got rid of the saw, they still had that big open pit, and they discovered it, and they decided just to put the boat in there.
Well, that's an interesting theory.
Well, that's what I thought. It's like, well, okay, yeah. Nobody knows for sure, and yeah, it's a pretty good idea.
But, you know, people are always going there to see the pyramids, and they didn't even know about these things right next to the pyramids.
No,
that
I
think are even stranger mystery.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. I mean, you can spend a lifetime studying that Giza Plateau and still not even scratch the surface of it.
Wouldn't it be great if all that sand were somehow just removed and you could really see what's under there?
Yeah, we need a giant vacuum or some kind of a giant fan just to blow it all away.
Right. Because you know there's
I mean, even
a whole city
even Zahi Hawass has stated publicly that what we see in Egypt is less than 30% of what's actually there.
I believe it, yeah.
And
can
now
see it.
We're using satellites. I saw a program the other night about an Egyptologist from Alabama who's using satellite imagery, and she's finding pyramids and temples all over the place.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you see that? And Hadi Sawas is excited about it because it's the first time they're finding it with satellite images. They can see it. And then they had him start digging, and they said, yes, there is something in these places that she found.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new way of, archaeology, really.
Exactly. I mean, it's incredible. And, there's just no telling what we're going to discover here in the coming years. I mean, it's just going to take our knowledge of the ancient world and just explode it.
William, is all of your information through research, or do you derive it from some other? I feel if you have some intuitive or something, you have some other mechanism involved.
Yeah, you get the hunches and that sort of thing, and you follow up on them, and you get occasionally the voice that says, go do this or that kind of thing. So that's, definitely a big part of it for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but otherwise it's all research? I mean, and then hands-on, I guess you go to the places and research.
Yeah, it's hands-on. I'm either, like I wrote a book about the dome of the U.S. Capitol, the symbols in the dome of the U.S. Capitol. So I went up there half a dozen times and spent a lot of time in the Capitol taking my own photos, and I really enjoy doing that kind of thing where it's, being the first person kind of to write about something and really explore it. So it's hands-on. And the historical research, I try to, I view myself as a person who's out here doing the research for other people, and I'm just trying to show them the pathway of where I went. So I want to reference everything and give them a sense of how they can follow the trail if they want to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I feel is, you see, not to take what everybody has said, these things are supposed to mean, but you find something, you have an intuition about it. This is different. This is something that nobody knows about, and that's what I want to find.
Exactly.
But it's exciting.
That's what makes it exciting.
There's no end to it. As long as you have an open mind, we can explore any of this, and that's what's exciting about it.
Exactly.
Mm.
And I try to keep it open-minded and open-ended as well. I mean, sometimes you can make really absolute conclusions, but other times we just don't know. So you can't come out and emphatically state that something is the way it is. You just have to say it could be, it might be, and it looks like this is what it's all pointing to.
Mm-hmm. But at least we don't have the skeptics in there saying, no, there's nothing to it. We're open to at least exploring it. That's
right.
The way I
exactly.
feel about it.
Exactly.
We ask lots and lots of questions.
Good ones, too.
Good ones,
yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. But you're going to be talking about these things at the conference, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I've got those two presentations, which I'm really looking forward to. I'll be doing PowerPoint presentations, so I'll have lots of graphics, lots of images. And
good.
I'm really looking forward to coming down there.
Okay. I saw on your description the Judgment Day device, and I was thinking, what's that? I've never heard of that before. So people are going to have to, you're going to have to come to the conference to find the answers.
Well, you can give us a little.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it relates to what we were talking about earlier, the Ark of the Covenant, which I believe is that device and the revelation of the Ark of the Covenant in our world. And part of what I'll be talking about is how modern science is now duplicating a lot of what the ancients said the Ark of the Covenant could do. And just imagine if that Ark were to reappear in our time, and what if all the beings that accompanied it were there as well? I mean, we're talking about a huge moment in human history that so many prophetic traditions have said is coming, and who knows? This might actually be the time when it actually happens.
Well, it definitely is the time of change, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
William, I had a while ago.
So,
I had another
video. I'll be showing lots of artwork I've collected that shows the Ark, especially, I mean, very often you don't see the complete Ark of the Covenant. They'll show you like a golden box and say that's the Ark of the Covenant, but it actually had additional pieces.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to get into and fully assemble it and show how it actually relates to us, how it relates to the human body as well.
Oh, okay. Well, then, do you have a question?
I was getting another visual about, because we're talking about it's a portal device and it could be a holographic thing, and you're talking about they used it to go to the heavens consciously, so that was a portal again. I got something where they were saying that we can actually just tap into the energy of this. You don't have to physically be there with it. You can actually just tap into the energy and use it. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you went right to the heart of the discovery in my book, is that over and over again, I mean, there's this reference, like, well, let me start here. Like, when Moses received the blueprint for the Ark of the Covenant on Mount Sinai,
it was
like a consciousness link that he made with Yahweh, the Old Testament God. And what that means is that the Ark of the Covenant was actually created in his mind first, and then they created it in the material world.
Okay.
And over again, I kept seeing this message related to the Ark of the Covenant that you can build this in your consciousness and link to this energy through your mind.
Okay.
You don't have to have the actual device.
Well,
then fish.
We got a little bit of time?
Yeah.
Just a few minutes. Yeah. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
That is exciting.
So
I love it when a visual I get
that
is affirmed. Keep going.
Presentation.
Yeah, Julia gets visuals that pop into her mind, and she trusts that. So we get our information in different ways.
That's great. Well,
okay,
she's really
good. I think we are coming to the time to stop. The hour has flown by anyway.
Yeah,
It's going to be very interesting to meet you again and be able to talk. And anybody who's listening out there, this is just the tip of the iceberg. William is going to give two separate 2-hour presentations, so that's 4 hours of listening to him. He's going to have a lot of material, so I'm sure you're going to find out a lot more by coming to the conference, plus all the other speakers, George Nuri and we've got, 11 other speakers besides that. So the conference is next week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 19th, 20th, and 21st, in Springdale, Arkansas, at the Holiday Inn Convention Center.
More information at OzarkMountain.com, OzarkMT.com, or DoloresCannon.com. You have a link on your site, too, don't you, William?
Yes, I do. My site's williamhenry.net. Just go to the events link and scroll down and you'll see it.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to sign off, but we'll be seeing you soon. And I'm
Thank
hoping
you so much, Dolores, Julia.
People listening will also
Absolutely.
Be coming.
Yeah.
We get to meet them.
Yeah. Thank you so much,
Forward
William.
To it. I'll see you all next weekend, next Thursday, actually.
Absolutely.
Yes, Thursday is the speaker dinner.
That's
okay,
right.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening tonight. And we're going to sign off, and we won't be on live next week because of the conference.
Yeah, so come on out and see us.
Yeah, but after that, I'll be live again all through August. So thanks for listening tonight.
Make it great.